Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. There is, you know, the lies and the growth of corruption and lies because devious and nefarious men have been working together to basically steal our wealth, steal our government, and subjugate us. It's clear that there's never been a delegation of power to the government to be able to incorporate, to subjugate, to do any of these things. This is why going through these founding documents literally lays out what the government is actually supposed to be doing and what they can't be doing. And as soon as you're connecting these dots, folks, you know, life gets simple. Enforce the Constitution. Learn, pray, act. Now, one of the things that Sean doesn't know, welcome back, Sean. But one of the things that Sean doesn't know is because we wrapped up the bank bill, we're actually covering a new document today. And that this will give him time to go find the document because it's not that he doesn't have it. He's got it. He just didn't know we're going to cover this next. The Coinage Act of April 2nd, 1792. This is important not because the bank bill, but this is important because of the constitutional requirement for the federal government to have and establish our currency based on precious metal, that the government's only authority for currency to be provided to the states is precious metal. I want you to think about that, folks, because we have electronic, we have paper, and we have uncommutable paper, by the way. And when I say we have paper, we allow a person to write a personal check from their bank that is an electronic holding, and that through the electronics will transfer money from one bank to another bank with routing indications and all of that, and it's done all automated, which is great. The problem is that that's one thing that's allowed, that the states have kind of allowed to simplify us not having to go down to, you know, the electrical company and pay them in gold or silver. They've done a few things to kind of simplify things. But to getting away from gold and silver is literally treasonous. They have no authority until they amend the Constitution to allow that to happen. And as a matter of fact, no state in the Union can allow anything other than gold and silver coin to be the legal tender of the payment of debt. That's right there in Article 1, Section 10. This is why we read the Constitution to you, so that when I say these things, oh, yeah, I remember you covered that. Yeah, I remember that. And I'm giving everybody a little bit of latitude that they actually do remember that. But nevertheless, the point is that we're going to cover the Coinage Act. And what I have here is really from, I believe this is actually from the Treasury Department. U.S. Mint Gov. Yes, so this is a Treasury document. What I need to do, to be honest, is I need to actually dive into the congressional record, and I have to get back to that, but there's a lot of other things I need to do. Folks, as we cover this content and as more people start getting involved in helping, it frees me up from doing these things. And or it allows me to get back and do these things specifically because I'm not right in anything else. You're out there leading the charge. This cannot be done by one man. I cannot be in every state of the union kicking butt in your state legislature demanding that they do their job. That's 50 places to be. And if you look at the state legislature sessions, they all convene at the same time. That is the way things are working today. It is impossible for one man to, in a reasonable period of time, get this nation back on track. It would only take a league of statesmen, where we have statesmen in every state, and as you know, in the state of Louisiana. We're nurturing and developing a statesman as we speak, because Sean is that man. Right, Sean?
See?
That's right. So what we want
to do... Yes.
Okay, so I gave you some time to find the document, right? So you've got it up
there. Oh, I have it, sir.
Okay, yeah. I know I didn't tell you, so that's how I kind of buy you time so you can pull it up. So this is interesting of what they do and how they go down this, because they made a system that allowed anybody to basically commute your gold and silver into currency. And it's not like they confiscated it. I want to be clear here. If you had gold and silver, that was your property. And if you turned it into the mint, they would give you back the currency that would equate to the weight that you gave them. In other words, this minting system and this transmuting and migration from paper currency to a gold and silver currency, we're going to read through this bill where it becomes a symbiotic relationship between the people and the government, and the government doesn't charge them. It's their duty to mint. That's what they legitimately have to pay for. They pay for the minting. So you don't pay to get, you don't have to pay a fee. Go look at what it costs to buy a coin today. Go to the usmint.gov and look at the value of gold today and ask yourself, why is it that you're paying such a premium price for a minted coin from the U.S. Mint? They're charging you for the service of allowing you to have that coin when it's their job to print those coins and give them to you. Not give them to you, but you pay them the value of that coin. The value, the face value, making money off of the printing of gold and silver is reprehensible. When we go through this act, when they started going back down, and this is becoming a common ploy of government. Oh, well, you got to pay for government. No. We already pay for your butts because we're paying taxes. You to transmit this thing that you're supposed to be doing to now a service that you sell. Sorry, that doesn't fly. We're already paying for your existence and you to function in these capacities. And for you to come back and make money off of us just shows how corrupt we have gone down this path. So, again, what we're going to do is we're going to dive into this. And this, I don't have anything really highlighted. And this is actually the first year we've gotten into the coinage and mint. The reason that we're bringing this in is because it was so critical in understanding the digital currency. When we use this to actually start arguing against the digital currency in the digital currency petition. So that being said, without any further ado, because I know Sean's just chomping at the bit, go ahead and let's start off with the establishing a mint and regulating the coins of the United States with Section 1. Go ahead.
Being enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, and is hereby enacted and declared that a mint for the purpose of a national coinage be, and the same is established, to be situated and carried on at the seat of the government of the United States for the time being, and that for the well conducting of the business of the said mint there shall be the following officers and persons, namely a director, an assayer, a chief coiner, an engraver, a treasurer.
Okay, there we go. So they've kind of created that it's going to be at the seat of government. In other words, by this point in time, they acknowledged that that was going to be the District of Columbia right there on the Potomac, because that was a part of the deal that was made with the Assumption Act a little bit earlier on the same year. Okay, so Section 2, go ahead.
And be it further enacted that the director of the mint shall employ as many clerks, workmen, and servants as he shall from time to time find necessary, subject to the approbations of the President of the United States.
Okay, so approbations or appropriations are definitely two different words. And so,
right.
So approbations is basically his consent. In other words, based on the consent of the president, they will be able to, you know, do this employment from time to time, hiring and so forth. Because technically, the Department of the Treasury, State Department, they all work for the president, because the president is faithfully executing the laws and providing these services that the law demands. Section 3, let's go ahead.
Section 3, and be it further enacted that the respective functions and duties of the officers above mentioned shall be as follow. The director of the mint shall have the chief management of the business thereof, and shall superintend all others, officers, and persons who shall be employed therein. The assayer shall receive and give receipts for all metals which may lawfully be brought to the mint to be coined, shall assay all such of them as may require it, and shall deliver them to the chief coiner to be coined. The chief coiner shall cause to be coined all metals which shall be received by him for that purpose, according to such regulations as shall be prescribed by this or any future law. The engraver shall sink and prepare the necessary dies for such coinage with the proper devices and inscriptions, but it shall be lawful for the functions and duties of chief coiner and engraver to be performed by one person. The treasurer shall receive from the chief coiner all of the coins which have been struck, and shall pay or deliver them to the persons respectively to whom the same ought to be paid or delivered. He shall moreover receive and safely keep all monies which shall be for the use, maintenance, and support of the mint, and shall disperse the same upon warrants signed by the director.
Okay, so pretty administrative stuff. And we're going to find that this is pretty administrative stuff. But you got to remember that we're going to get into some things that kind of expand, because they realized that not all things could be gold and silver. So we're going to notice that they actually include copper. And then down the road, they started including things like nickel, and or a combination of silver and copper, like we see in the dime. And so what I think, where we are today, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. So let's go ahead and read section 3. Or 4, I mean. My bad.
Section 3.
4.
4, yeah. And be it further enacted that every officer and clerk of the said mint shall, before he enters upon the execution of his office, take an oath or affirmation before some judge of the United States, faithfully and diligently to perform the duties thereof.
And included in that,
pesky oath again.
There you go. And included in that is the requirement to support the Constitution, because that was a part of the congressional administration of the oath, that every employee of the federal government would be held to an oath, and that they would be legally bound to supporting the Constitution. So any employee in the employ of the United States, federal United States, that is actually working, you know, with Communist China and, or, you know, others, and providing information, spying, or anything like that, that is involved in an insurrection or involved in fighting and or basically violating the Constitution, giving aid and comfort to those that are, what have you, they violated their oath. They should actually be stripped of office. They should be stripped of citizenship. Our forefathers and the men that initiated this federal government, the spirit was truly poured upon them to create a definitive accountability, not to God, not to the people, not to the president, not to the party, but to the Constitution. Because that right there was the inspiration of the divine hand of providence. That's why, folks, I'm going to remind you again, Thanksgiving is coming up, and the whole point of Thanksgiving, the first year of this government when it formed, the whole purpose of having that Thanksgiving was to fast and to serve him by going out and serving others and recognizing, you know, what he had done by giving us this Constitution specifically. So I just saying, folks, if your heart is really seeking the change, then the change has to start with you. Anyway, let's go ahead and read the Section 6. Or is it 5? Yes, it is. Sir. Go ahead.
And be it further enacted that the said assayer, chief coiner, and treasurer, previously to entering upon the execution of the respective offices, shall each become bound to the United States of America with one or more sureties to the satisfaction of the Secretary of the Treasury in the sum of $10,000, with condition for the faithful and diligent performance of the duties of his office.
Okay, so what is this saying?
They have to have a bond.
Is it requiring them to have a bond? You seeing that? Where's that? Other than they're saying, so let's read this again, that the said sayer, chief coiner, and treasurer, previously to entering upon the execution of their respective offices, shall each become bound to the United States of America with one or more sureties to the satisfaction of the Treasury in the sum of $10,000 with condition for the faithful and diligent performances of their duties of this office. Now, this is the first time that kind of language, because they didn't say bond, but that's what they're basically talking about. But it actually says one or more sureties, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
So it could be this, it could be this and something else, or it could be something else. But at this point in time, they felt, and why would they have $10,000? Because thinking about the sum of $10,000, these men were going to be in a room with gold that might actually come to some amount close to $10,000. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So this is a security.
That way, if the money goes missing, the mint doesn't lose their money. They just take it from the supervisor.
Well, they pull it out of that bond that they paid for.
Right.
Yeah. In other words, it's kind of like collateral, because we're going to give you this responsibility of holding this money. The concept of a bond is not constitutional unless it is for a security purpose. In other words, you're going to be sitting on a lot of money, and you're going to have a significant bond where you may not have to pay. You use your house as the bond, right? But even then, 9 times out of 10, nobody today has that kind of money to back those types of bonds. That makes sense, right? We're talking, you know, billions of dollars. Who lives in a home that's billions of dollars? Right. Nobody, right? So anyway, I understand the intent. The intent was to ensure that a person that was going to be in a position to have the ability to harm the government by stealing, by all of a sudden be going bad and stealing something, that it was a security to protect the government from a bad player. That was the intent behind this. When we look at the bonds today that people talk about, those aren't constitutional, because the bonds that people are taking out is holding people accountable in protecting the government, not the Constitution. Big difference. So, because I've yet to see, because this is specific language, and the question is, was this necessary and proper in the federal Constitution to be able to hold these people who were going to have access to such sums of gold? Yeah, it actually does make sense. It's necessary and proper to provide a security. But for everybody else, no. And when you look at the state government, where does that happen in the language of your state government? Is a necessary and proper clause there? Or is there the necessity of creating a bond? I've yet to see these things in state governments. It's what ended up happening when the corporations were created unconstitutionally. They started creating everybody to hold a bond to them, because they were all about money. Government has never been and never should have been about money. They're not to possess or be a holder of massive wealth. Government is we the people. That wealth is we the people. Anyway, Let's go to Section 6.
Section 6, and be it further enacted there that there shall be allowed and paid as compensation for their respective services to the said director a yearly salary of $2,000, to the said assayer a yearly salary of $1,500, to the said chief coiner a yearly salary of $1,500, to the said engraver a yearly salary of $1,200, to the said treasury a yearly salary of $1,200, to each clerk who may be employed a yearly salary not exceeding $500, and to the several subordinate workmen and servants such wages and allowances as are customary and reasonable according to their respective stations and occupations.
So let me ask you this, because you have the ability to go do research. When you look at a $2,000 salary for a yearly compensation for the director of the Mint, where does that fall in compensation? Is that a handsome concept compensation, or is that a, you know, trifling? I mean, the reality is you're going to find that these were some of the top wages being offered in their time. In other words, when you look at what this person does, you know, does a, he's a director. Actually, let's look at the chief coiner. And to the said chief coiner, yearly salary of $1,500. So go and look at an ironsmith or a person that does artwork with metal and so forth in, you know, doing the minting. What was the salary of a person that was doing that out there on the economy? I'm going to venture to say that $1,500 was well above the average person doing it on their own.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead. You're going to say
I did look it up, and $2,000 a year in 1792 is equivalent to about $52,000 a year today.
Okay, but yeah, so that's, if you look at what people were making, so what did Congress make? What was Congress's first compensation? You know, how much did the members of Congress for their first session or their first term, what did Congress make for the first term, which was 2 years? How much did the representatives in the House of Representatives get compensated? What was their compensation? The very first payout to them. If you look that up, now we're looking at, you know, how much was Congress paying themselves and how much were these employees getting paid? Because I understand that there were wages, and in the metropolises, wages were inflated, but it was not the norm. That was, you know, $500 was a lot of money to the average American. The people, you know, providing for themselves. And so, as we...
$6 per day.
It's $6 a day for the days they work, and how many days did they work? Because it wasn't that many.
By 1792, Congress had not yet adopted an annual salary. The per diem of $6 per day remained in effect until 1855. There was no official annual salary in 1792.
So how many days did Congress work in 1792? How many days were they in session? Days of session. So we're going into break. Look it up, and we can get back to the Coin Act when we come back from this break, folks. So he's trying to create this perspective that, you know, government salaries, when they were creating these, in some reasons, in some respects, they needed to actually pay these people well because they didn't want them to steal. They didn't want to have to replace them. I mean, keeping their domain knowledge was critical. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so the hamsters on the internet were running rapidly as Sean was doing these searches. And so I'm going to guess probably Congress was in session maybe 100 days.
Actually, 404 days in their first term.
In their first 404 days, because they were probably doing a lot of work. So, okay, so divide that by 202 days, right, and times that by 6, because that's how the math works out, you know, because there's 2 years in a term. So 202 days times 6, 202 times 6, it's going to be $1,212. So they were making less than the chief coiner. Okay. And that compensation being set at $6 a day, they were just calling that a per diem. What was the U.S. Senate being paid in compensation? As you look that up, you know, that's kind of probably
a good... I just said Congress, representatives in Congress. I can look up where...
U.S. Senators, what was the U.S. Senators' first pay and compensation? Something like that. It's just a matter of creating that language to, you know, to pull in that string. But anywho, getting back to the COIN Act while you're kind of looking at that, we're going to skip down.
Actually, we got paid the same thing, $6 per day.
Okay.
Although a proposal was made in 1789 to pay senators $7 per day, it was not implemented until 1795 and only for a brief period.
Okay. Fair enough. So let's get back to the bill. And let's get down to Section 8, because this is where they're starting to change in the focus and into... Because Section 9 is really where they get into the quality of the coins and the type of coins, the type of metal, and so forth. So let's do the kind of the read or the precursor to Section 9, which would be 8. So let's start with 8. Go ahead.
And be it further enacted that in addition to the authority vested in the President of the United States by a resolution of the last session, touching the engagement of artists and the procuring of apparatus for the said mint, the President be authorized, and he is hereby authorized, to cause to be provided and put in proper condition such buildings and such manner shall appear to him requisite for the purpose of carrying on the business of the said mint, and that as well the expenses which shall have been incurred pursuant to the said resolution, as those which may be incurred in providing, preparing said buildings, and all other expenses which may hereafter accrue for the maintenance and support of the said mint, and in carrying on the business thereof, over and above the sums which may be received by the reason of the rate per centum for coinage herein after mentioned, shall be defrayed from the treasury of the United States out of any monies which from time to time shall be therein not otherwise appropriated.
Okay, so basically the President has this, you know, this freedom of being able to you know, take care of the building of the mint, you know, the fundamental real estate, the fundamental administrative property, let's call it that. So Section 9 is now where we actually start talking about the gold and silver. So let's go ahead.
And be it further enacted that there shall be from time to time struck in coin that the said mint, coins of gold, silver, and copper of the following denominations, values, and descriptions. VIZ, I'm not sure what that abbreviation
Viz,
is for.
Yeah, VIZ is like, it's kind of like a legal term, vis-a-vis, for example, kind of like right. An EG.
Okay. Eagles, each to be of the value of $10 or units and to contain 247 grains and 4/8 of grain of pure or 270 grains of standard gold. Half eagles, each to be the value of $5 to contain 123 grains and 6/8 of a grain of pure or 135 grains of standard gold. Quarter eagles, each to be of the value of $2 and a half dollar, and to contain 61 grains and 7/8 grains of a grain of pure, or 67 grains and 4/8 of a grain of standard gold. Dollars, or the same, is now current, and to contain 371 grains and 4/16 parts of a grain of pure, or 416 grains of standard silver. Half dollars, each to be of half the value of the dollar or unit, and to contain 185 grains and 10/16 parts of a grain of pure, or 2/8 of a grain of standard silver. Quarter dollars, each to be 1/4 of the value of a dollar or unit, and to contain 92 grains and 13/16 parts of a grain of pure, or 104 parts of 4 grains of standard silver. Dimes, or dismes, each to be of the value of 1/10 of a dollar a unit, and to contain 37 grains and 2/16 parts of a grain of pure, or 41 grains and 3/5 parts of a grain of standard silver. Half dimes, each to be of the value of 1/20 of a dollar, and to contain 18 grains and 9/16 parts of a grain of pure, or 20 grains and 4/5 part of a grain of standard silver. Cents, each to be of the value of the 1/100th part of a dollar, and to contain 11 penny weights of copper. Half cents, each to be the value of half a cent, and to contain 5 penny weights and half a penny weight of copper. Hence the word pennies, correct?
That is correct. As a matter of fact, it's interesting because copper was not included in the language. Gold and silver, right?
Right.
So they concluded that they needed to have a less costly precious metal that they could use as a, like a pence or a penny, because that even goes back to, the Britain and their coinage system and many other governments that actually did use gold, silver, and copper. Now, copper is actually a kind of a beautiful metal, but it tarnishes easily. Brass is another one, but brass is actually not a metal itself. It's an amalgamation of metal, right? So today, we actually have more precious metals than they knew back then. And the only reason is because we have gone to great lengths in defining in the element table basically the atomic weight of every type of metal, which is where palladium and platinum and those types of metals have come out. Back in the day, you know, when they looked at this silver type of metal, it wasn't as shiny as regular silver. So they didn't think it was of the same value. Does that make sense?
Yes,
so that's
sir.
Why platinum platinum and palladium and these different metals kind of just became, they just maintained obscurity just because they lacked the luster. but they are considered precious metals. Today, in getting back to a precious metal system, we could actually expand our holdings of both gold, silver, and going into some of these other metals to where they would equate to either and I think currently, let me pull it up. And oh, by the way, I know about 2 years ago, I advised everybody, 3-4 years ago, I was going through Monex and all of that, right? And I was telling people, you know, I'd highly recommend you go out and buy your silver years ago. And, you know, I don't have Monex on here, so let me kind of, because it's worth mentioning, what the heck is gold worth today? When I told everybody to go buy, gold was well under $2,000. Today, when we look at the live silver and gold prices, I'm only doing this because I want to get into these other precious metals, gold is now well over $4,000. It's $4,070. Silver is $50. And back in the day when we were looking at it, it was somewhere between $16 to $18. And actually, I think we even pointed out a window during that time where I was telling people to buy. It dipped even below that. So had you gone out and bought silver, your silver would be probably well over twice its value. Over twice its value, what you paid for. Gold, twice its value. Actually, double the value for silver and twice the value, or quadruple the value for silver, double the value for gold. Now I'm making sense. Platinum is $1,500 and palladium is around $1,400. So I could see platinum and basically, you know, it would create a shift in the precious metal values, because what is the intent of a precious metal and what causes its value? Well, if it's based on supply and demand, if there's an equal supply of platinum and an equal supply of palladium, then they would be about equal. The 9 times out of 10, things aren't always equal. And the reason why gold has its highest value is because of the perceived limitation of gold on, you know, that exists on the earth. Now, these may have been myths that we started and we just believe these things. And now, you know, science kind of knows, you know, what is the full repository of gold on the planet? It's just it's a scientific guess, but it's far more accurate than it was centuries ago. And it's the same thing with silver. It's the same thing with palladium and platinum and so forth. But my point is that, you know, people go, well, we can't get gold and all these things, you know, to kind of equate to our economy. Or can we? If we expand palladium, platinum, and other precious metals into our currency, not to our economy, but into our currency, that's what I meant, then it becomes a very reasonable reach of being able to expand. We would expand the size of the storage, like Fort Knox or what have you, where all these bars would sit. But there would also need to be the exchanges that would need to be repopulated so that you folks could actually go down and turn in cash, turn in commutable paper, which is what we would be using as the currency, that you go write a check, you withdraw from your account, they give you commutable paper bills, $100, $500. And this would actually create the initial need for $500, maybe even $1,000 bills. But as we start suppressing the amount of paper, because government isn't spending it out anymore. They're not flooding the economy. They're not flooding dollars or paper into circulation. As the paper starts getting pulled back out, that circulation goes down and inflation then goes down with it. So there are a few things that obviously, and I'm not a subject matter expert on doing this, but I would say that we couldn't move forward without actually expanding the precious metal system, so that if you're going to hold large valued bars, coin type of thing, we would need to implement, I would say, palladium and platinum, you know, as an interim so that maybe two bars of palladium would equal one bar of platinum or whichever. So that, does it make sense now that we, you know, instead of saying that gold is going to be everything, we actually increase the value of gold by introducing these intercessions between silver and gold? That makes sense.
I'm totally at a loss for even how that system works, to be honest with you.
Well, so so the way that the bills or currency works is based on the value in both in the gold itself as well as the amount of bills in circulation. So, in other words,
how would we rectify that?
Let's go to cash
crops. Amount of money that the United States government has in issue.
Well, so let's use the cash crop, because I think this is a really good way of explaining the value of a cash crop. Cash crops can be anything, and let's use tomatoes as a cash crop, because if all of a sudden you grow lots of tomatoes and the market is filled with tomatoes, the value of tomatoes really go down. It takes a lot of tomatoes to, you know, to exchange for something else. It's right. The same thing with gold. So the reason why gold has always been highly valued is because of the perceived limitation of the supply of gold in the world and underground. So
right. And the cost to extract it in.
Correct. But actually, when we look at the cost of extracting, that would be something that somebody would actually be baking into their cost. Because, see, when the miners pulled gold out, all they did was they turned that gold into the mint, and they would get back coins, bars, what have you, of the equal weight. And so pulling gold out is a newfound, it's like work. Right? You were working to pull that out. That becomes your pay.
Actually is.
Right? So you're being paid for the work by extracting that. I mean, it's pretty lucrative if you have a very good paying mine. The problem was, and the problem today is that the governments have claimed, you know, full ownership of these mines. And the what they call mineral rights. Well, technically, that's never happened. The federal government does not have the authority to demand or create mineral rights. The mineral rights should be at a minimum, if it's controlled by a government, at the highest level, it could only be controlled by the state. As far as I'm concerned, I believe the mineral rights need to be controlled down at the county level, because not all counties are equal, and each county has its own interests. And when we look at what gold counties are today in our makeup, our demographics of government, the counties that are along the seaward edge, in other words, along the coastlines, that's the most valuable. Why? It's the most desirable. It's where the climate is usually the most consistent. People like living there for the climate. There is an exchange of commerce, because most commerce comes from the sea and goes across, especially international commerce. It's very costly to fly things in, coming in via ship. So when we look at if you look at the whole world, I believe that there's a high percentage, like 80%, maybe more than that, of the whole world population lives within 250 nautical miles of the coastline of the continents and so forth. The inner areas of continents are very sparsely populated, because there's just far more commerce and far more things and desires to be able to do where there's more people. That's why, you know, the abandonment of the Central America, or not Central America, but the center of America, you know, in the urban areas, ghost towns. There's communities that just have went away because people decided not to live there anymore because somebody bought out or destroyed the farming, whatever. But with getting into the concept of mineral rights, should we amend our state constitution? Until we do, the state doesn't have mineral rights. When we create our county constitutions, that's where we need to ensure that your county possesses the mineral rights and has sole control over the mineral rights of the county to ensure that the state can't suppress your rights and basically say, we're going to keep you from being able to harvest those, anything like that. That has to be done by you and the people of your community, whether you want people to be able to harvest, you know, the good minerals under the land or not. This also helps, you know, shift the accountability of the environment of, you know, strip mining or the consequences of those types of things, because you're doing it to yourself, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that's why, you know, we see how corporations, the people that own those corporations, they don't even live there. And that's why they actually, you know, implement these measures of, they don't care if they kill people because they're not living there. Well, if it's being held and managed at that micro level, then I think most people are going to say, you know, we want to do business good. We don't want to kill ourselves. That's just stupid. Anyway, so when we actually start and we exchange that mineral rights, or if actually the county shares the mineral rights with the people that own the property, what have you. But this is a discussion that we have to have, because at this point in time, the federal government has unconstitutionally pulled it in. We have another problem with property ownership. We've actually got kings who have been able to amass such wealth that they've purchased up all of our land. I believe, and I actually said this in a phone call that I think you missed, I believe that reinstating the Homestead Acts, you know, in other words, homesteading, if a person owns land in your county, Bill Gates owns a farm in your county, and he's not there, he's not occupying that, and he's not occupying it. In other words, it's not his residence. He may have employees. He may have, you know, just an administrative body sitting there that is, you know, a placeholder. He's paying that person. Then that property, as far as I'm concerned, should be open and available for anybody to actually go in and homestead and actually make improvements to where that land becomes productive land and help start actually paying and developing the economy and the revenue of the good people in that county, in that state. That was the whole point of homesteading, was to get people to come in, harvest the resources of the land so that the state could start making money. And Bill Gates is waging economic warfare, starving the state of the needed funds, because that's why we don't have family farms anymore. I'm hoping this is starting to make sense, because when we start unleashing the economy and we basically open up property rights once again to anybody and everybody, that people cannot amass property. It is, you know, it's okay, but every state should actually have homestead laws that say, if you're not going to be the resident there, then you stand at risk, because if somebody desires that property, because all of a sudden it's desirable, and they take that, they put their, all they've got to do is put their home there, and then they can create a lodge. Maybe it's a nice view area. Maybe it's not something you can mine on or, you know, farm on, but maybe you could create a little hotel, you know, for ski runs or, you know, for what we would call services and, you know, tourism, those types of things. It doesn't matter. The point is that these conversations need to be had down at the county level to go to the state level, so that we can actually keep these self-made monarchs from stealing our liberty, stealing our rights, and stealing our land. Because that's what they've been doing. And they've been protected by a facade of government that actually has no delegated right to control those things, to allow those things to be done. The state has only been allowing these things because the federal government says, yeah, foreign entities and these people that aren't residents, yeah, they can come up and buy up your land. They can take ownership of you. They can start telling you what to do. In a Republican form of government, let's keep a very close perspective, because I've talked about a concept called all elections local. The only people that should have any voice in who is going to be represented and any say to those people are the people that live there. Anybody that's bringing money from out of county is considered a person into an election, a person putting money into an election that they don't live in that county, and it's a county election, that that person is actually engaging in election tampering. They have no voice. They have no stake in it. They should not be able to put a penny into it or even, you know, say, I endorse this person. That right there is election. Like when Trump does this, that doesn't matter what your station is. You know, people listen to you and you tell people, oh, you got to vote for this guy. That guy should be charged for election tampering because it's between the people and who are the candidates to choose who they believe is best. And when you want to step in because they're going to be a shill for you, or whatever, for whatever reason, it's election tampering. You have to actually prove that you have a dog in the fight. You actually are, you know, skin in the game. You own property. You live there. Only those people have a right to be engaged in the dialogue, discussion, and the election of who's going to represent them. Making all elections local takes away these monarchs' power. Takes away these globalist powers, the corporations' powers. So there are ways that, you know, we can actually create. This is why I called it, in 2020, I called it the Bill of Rights for the 21st century. And these are ways of creating protectionist laws to actually guard our property rights, to guard our liberties, and so forth and so on. So... We're almost out of time. I've kind of fire hosed you. You probably got a lot of questions or complaints or comments. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No complaints. We can strike those off.
Okay.
Not for you, anyway.
So go ahead. But I mean, these are kind of new concepts. But bottom line, the problems that we're dealing with have everything to do with these assumed powers that government has done. That has created a stage that has created benefits for the affluent and right. For government.
The leverage and power in the sense that they've devalued the currency and just destroyed any chance for the average person to have, you know, a prosperous life so that they could benefit from it because they have access to these, you know, immense pools of imaginary money, and they can use that to leverage their own industries and leverage, you know, influence within the country, while the people that are just working, trying to raise their families, are their cost of living is constantly being raised to where it's almost impossible, you know, to sustain yourself. Because the people at the top have devalued everything for their own purposes,
or they've raised the cost and prices of everything to where you can no longer afford to stay in your home. They're basically running you out of your county. They're running you out of your state, and this is economic
running you out of your family.
Yes,
by making your wife have to go out and work in order for you to feed your children.
Right. All right, folks. With that, obviously, that music means that it's time to terminate the conversation. When we come back, we'll do a quick review of the final parts of this Coinage Act and dive into some new content. It's all about the content, folks, and I believe what we're going to do is Madison's essay on property next with that, because I think it's important that we start looking at their perspective. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.